The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
So that showed overall, if we compared semaglutide to empagliflozin, there was about an 11% reduction in risk with semaglutide compared to empagliflozin.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled, Comparison of Semaglutide or Dulaglutide versus Empagliflozin for Risk of Death and Cardiovascular Outcomes Among Patients with Type 2 Diabetes, Two Target Trial Emulation Studies. Joining us on the podcast are two of the authors, Kevin Kipp, PhD, who's the VP for Clinical Analytics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Anim Saeed, who's an assistant professor of cardiology at UPMC. We hope you learn something and enjoy this podcast.
Kip and Anim, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I was really intrigued by the concept of your article comparing a GLP-1 to an SGLT-2. And I think that this is an important topic that we're going to be talking about for the next 5, 10, 15 years as to what drugs to use at what time with type 2 diabetes. So why don't we start out by making sure that everybody understands the study design?
So we have a very large health system here at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. So this was based on our electronic health record data. And we try to emulate what they call target trials. So we try to emulate a randomized controlled trial, even though we're using our retrospective data that are collected in our electronic health record system. So it's a cohort type analysis designed to emulate a couple clinical trials. And we do that by applying the same inclusion and exclusion criteria that would be used in a randomized clinical trial. And then we select patients and match them very, very carefully on a whole host of characteristics. So after the matching, it will look as if they were actually randomly assigned, like you would see in a clinical trial, that they're very, very similar in their profiles. So that's the basic concept, is to try to emulate a clinical trial called target trial, but using our observational electronic health record data.
Great. And we've had some emulation studies on the podcast recently. Myself or many of the listeners really totally understand it, but your explanation was excellent. Here's the big question. What are the data sources? What are the eligibility criteria? So, you know, if this was a randomized controlled trial, because it's a pseudo-randomized controlled trial, who's in that study?
So the data sources are from all of our clinical facilities, and it was actually a little over 700 clinical practices. So we're a very large organization. And to be eligible, you had to be treated or at least prescribed a prescription for either semaglutide, dulaglutide, or empagliflozin. Those were the three drugs we looked at. And you couldn't have been on one of those within the prior year or two, what they call a washout period. And then, you had to meet the types of criteria that would be used in a clinical trial. So there are contraindications to semaglutide and empagliflozin, such as history of thyroid cancer or impaired kidney function. So we applied those conventional exclusion criteria that would have been used in a clinical trial if they had compared head-to-head a GLP-1 with an SGLT2. So again, it's our very large network of about 700 clinical facilities who had received a prescription for at least one of these medications. Now, they could be on other concomitant meds like metformin, but they couldn't have been on, let's say, both a GLP-1 and an SGLT2.
Was there any age restriction?
Yeah, so I was just going to sort of piggyback on what Kevin already mentioned. So you had to be 45 years and older to be included in our, in our sort of cohort. And those are the parameters that you would put in the EHR data set when you're creating the cohort for the study. The other important aspect of the cohort was they had the documentation of having had diabetes, type 2 diabetes, essentially. So 40, and you know, the listeners can allude to the paper for the detailed eligibility criteria of the population, the study population, because it's there. But in addition to what Kevin said, you know, you had to have type 2 diabetes diagnosis. You had to have a, you had to be 45 years or older. And you, the other thing is you had to have seen within the UPMC facilities or our university hospital settings across the Pennsylvania, greater Western Pennsylvania region in the last 5 years.
Okay, let's go with the randomized controlled trial concept. What is the primary outcome, secondary outcome, so that we know why we did this study?
So the primary outcome is what's called, your listeners probably know, a composite outcome, where you bundle a few together. So have any of those happened? And by the way, the median follow-up in this is about 2.2 years. But the primary outcome was death. And I'll mention it's all-cause death because we don't have good information on determining specific cause. And that has implications for our results. So it's death, heart attack, meaning MI, or stroke. So if you had any of those, you were put into the category of a value of one. You had the event of interest and otherwise zero. Now, we did secondary analysis looking at each of those individually, death, MI, or stroke. And in particular, we looked at stroke and MI together because those are hard, you know, cardiovascular disease endpoints, as opposed to death would include some non-cardiac deaths.
Okay. And then you I know you looked at some other things.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What we call the tertiary outcomes here, that was a change in the weight of the participants or the patient population and the change in hemoglobin A1C.
Okay.
At 6 and 12 months.
So I always look at table one when I look at these studies to try to figure out who the patients are. Could you give us a brief overview of the highlights? You know, gender, racial composition, average age, BMI, things like that.
I'll probably have to pull it up, but yeah. Let me start by saying what we're fundamentally interested in, and maybe we can pull it up in a second, but is before the matching process, how were the groups different? So in particular, those that received semaglutide and those that received empagliflozin, and sort of the highest level summary is, patients that received semaglutide, they were about 4 years younger, I think about 62 mean age. I think it was about 66 for empagliflozin. They tended to be more likely to be female, but had a much higher BMI on average, body mass index. But I guess if you'd say the overall risk profile, probably because of the age difference between, was slightly skewed toward higher risk for the empagliflozin group. So that's, again, before the matching. After our propensity score matching, we made the groups, which ended up about 8,000 in each group, very, very similar.
Yeah, so ultimately the match group, so I'm looking at the table one, Bob, in the empagliflozin group, the mean age turned to be 64.4, and in the semaglutide group being 63.7, as Kevin already mentioned, we're looking at about 49% of the population in the semaglutide group and 45% or so of the population in the empagliflozin group being women. And, most of them predominantly a self-reported white racial makeup, 10% Black, self-reported race here. Most of these, or half of the participants that were ultimately included in the propensity matched table one data here, we had a commercial insurance with that, and about 47 to 49% had Medicare. And those, that's pretty much the highlight of the patient population we're looking at. And again, regionally, this is based in the Western Pennsylvania geographical location.
If I could make one other statement too, Bob. During this quote matching process, you can do what's direct or indirect. And we did a direct match, means identical on which geographic type or which clinical group you were part of. Because if you think a randomized controlled trial, they usually randomize by clinical site. We did it by which year you started treatment in case there were secular trends. And we did it by whether you're a member of our health plan, which is our insurance plan. So we did an exact one-to-one on those because we felt those were very important. And then the other ones are closely matched, like age, but not directly one-to-one.
So, and I had asked about BMI, and I looked it up myself, and the average BMI is around 35, a little bit less for the empagliflozin, a little bit more for semaglutide. And I want everybody to notice that even though this article looked at duaglutide also, the numbers are very small, and the most important part of this article is just semaglutide versus empagliflozin. What were the years, the beginning year and the end year for this study, to try to put that into context?
Enrolled from 2019 to 24. That's why the median follow-up was a little more than 2 years, because we had some with, you know, relatively short follow-up.
Yeah. Great. Okay. So now we know what the study is. What does it show? So number one, we have the cardiac and stroke and mortality data. So what did that show?
So that showed overall, if we compared semaglutide to empagliflozin, there was about an 11% reduction in risk with semaglutide compared to empagliflozin. And that was for the, again, the catch-all, death, MI, or stroke, which includes cardiac death. So again, I mentioned this earlier. When we looked at the subset for stroke and MI alone, it's about a 19% reduction in risk with treatment with semaglutide.
That's right. And I think that it's worthwhile to mention that we didn't see this difference in the dulaglutide versus empagliflozin group.
Okay. And we expect there to be a difference in weight loss. I don't know if we expect to have a difference in glycemic control, but I know that you did.
Yeah, I would put it, I mean, Anam is the clinician here, I'm not, but I put it in the category of nominal to modestly lower or greater reduction in weight and hemoglobin A1C with semaglutide. Nothing that, you know, stands off as earth-shattering, but a noticeable difference.
Okay. So now we know that there's some decrease. I know you did subgroup analyses, so maybe we could discuss the subgroup analyses, and then we'll talk a little bit about sensitivity analysis, and then I'll try to figure out how to wrap all this up so that we know whether or not this is, in what way is this going to impact me as a clinician?
Okay, so for the subgroup analyses, which are exploratory, we should make that known to your listener. Okay. We didn't have preconceived, you know, hypotheses. The two that stood out was the benefit with semaglutide over empagliflozin was about lower risk of the primary outcome, death, MI, or stroke, around 25% lower if you were less than age 65, and about 25% lower if you started with a hemoglobin A1C less than 7. So you could put that in the category of maybe the earlier stage, you know, treatment seemed to have a more beneficial effect.
And so for those of us over 65, you don't find as much of a benefit.
And it's exploratory, but the data don't indicate that. That's correct.
Right. And obviously, this is not a large randomized controlled trial. It's it's a, you know, the, we don't know what the underlying reasons were that people used the medications. We just know they used the medications. Did you do any sensitivity analyses of these data?
We did, and what we found is in the Anna had mentioned most of our facilities are in Western Pennsylvania, but we're also scattered throughout the state and even a little bit into New York and Maryland. And the largest reduction in risk for death, MI, and stroke with semaglutide seemed to be concentrated in our greater Western Pennsylvania area. And we don't have a terrific explanation for that other than it could have been greater access to healthcare because of our health plan and the number of facilities here and otherwise. So there could be something to the effect of, you know, the benefit that we've observed with semaglutide, it's contingent on being engaged in the healthcare system in a pretty meaningful, consistent way. We don't know that, but we were a little bit struck by seeing that geographic variation.
Yeah, and I think I would like to support that, that there are reports of a higher access to healthcare facilities and, you know, socioeconomic status in the Southwest region as opposed to more of the peripheries. But again, and I kind of want to go back to Kevin's point about the, and Bob, your observation of the older versus younger than 65 folks. I think the other thing we were, and this is all hypothesis based, is that, you know, when you're younger, you've had a relatively shorter duration of risk factors as opposed to being older. And sometimes there's credible data and a lot of evidence to show that younger individuals, and now these are not 20-year-olds, but these are, you know, we're talking at a midlife area where adherence may be a little bit better to medications as opposed to, and the risk factor profile. But again, all plausible hypotheses here, none of which what we really, really explored and can give confirmation on.
One of the things that I really like about your paper is that you pointed out four key findings. And so I think that that puts a lot of things into context. If you could go over those for the listeners, I think it'd be really worthwhile.
Yeah. I mean, I think the four key findings here, and that's in the discussion is always how we like to put our papers. The first paragraph kind of summarizing what, if your listeners are more interested in that, I think the first thing, first and foremost, that our results suggest that treatment with semaglutide as opposed to when compared to empagliflozin may be more beneficial for our primary composite endpoint, which is a endpoint made of MI, stroke, and all-cause death in our group over a two-year time period given forth. This was particularly in subgroup analysis seen to be more significant for individuals who are lower than or younger than 65 years of age. The second finding is that the treatment advantage of semaglutide was probably mostly driven by a more pronounced reduction in risk for stroke as an individual outcome and not really MI and death. And thirdly, dulaglutide, which is our secondary emulated trial here, dulaglutide versus empagliflozin, that did not show any meaningful difference between those two medications and that. And I think the fourth one, which we were just talking about, are some of our modest effects, better effects of semaglutide were in the setting of a more pronounced reduction in hemoglobin A1C and a little bit of higher weight loss in the semaglutide group as opposed to empagliflozin.
And if I could just add one thing, Bob. The, you know, Anum summarized it very well, but the design of the trial, again, you know, us looking at semaglutide versus empagliflozin, because those are the two most widely used GLP-1 agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors. But the decision to include dulaglutide was to judge a class effect. That's the second most commonly used GLP-1 in our system. So again, these findings of an apparent beneficial effect with semaglutide doesn't seem to transfer to our second most frequently used GLP-1 agonist. So it doesn't appear to be a class effect. And that was the purpose for including that, quote, second emulated trial.
So yeah. Now I'm going to challenge you. And one of the reasons I'm doing that is because these are questions that came to my mind. Number one, I don't see any data on kidney disease, and that's certainly a concern when you're taking care of these patients. It's just average 2-year data, and so we don't know what the longer term effect might be. And you sort of alluded to what's the impact of weight loss, and that'll get to the final thing is, now that it's 2025, how many people are on tirzepatide rather than semaglutide, and will you need to do another emulation study down the road since so many people are going to be on tirzepatide? I know that's a lot, but why don't y'all try to handle that?
Okay, I'll give it a shot on them.
Go for it, Kevin. I believe
With respect to the tirzepatide, it's a perfect question that we should try to answer in the future once we get a sufficient amount of data with at least a reasonable amount of follow-up. And the reason being, in our analyses, we showed, again, I classified it as nominally the modest greater reduction in weight in HbA1c with semaglutide. And that held true against both empagliflozin and dulaglutide. So it held true. However, as you know, the early clinical trial data coming out with tirzepatide is actually suggesting that there could be greater weight reduction and potentially drop in HbA1c. So if our results are mechanistically aligned in that regard, and potentially tirzepatide is even more advantageous, that's a real reason, as soon as we have sufficient data, we should do that same emulated trial like you've suggested.
I agree. Yeah, I that would be very meaningful. Although I think there's a recent paper looking at semaglutide versus tirzepatide in randomized controlled data. I have to look at it a little bit. Bob, that might be something.
Yeah, we've already done a podcast on that.
Yeah.
And I think it's coming out soon. And the weight loss with tirzepatide is much more significant.
Right.
But that did not look at complications. It just looked at weight loss. And so that I'm getting more and more articles that are suggesting that tirzepatide is doing more good things, at least in terms of weight loss. And this is a fairly weighty population. What about, you know, the kidney disease is a tough one. We know that both classes delay the progression of kidney disease. And you didn't design it for this, and the data probably wouldn't show it, but it'd be interesting to see whether or not there's any difference in incident kidney disease. And it would also be interesting to see if you could extend after a year or two to see what happens over time, because 2 years seems to be sort of short. All that being said, what are you telling your colleagues about this? And if you have private insurance, I guess you can get them to pay for semaglutide and empagliflozin. They're expensive drugs, and not everybody can afford to take them. So that's just something that I always like to mention, that we're dealing with very good new drugs that might be out of pocket, very difficult to pay for.
I think that's a very fair assessment and a lived reality of the clinicians every day, right? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of really cool new drugs, very beneficial drugs that we hope we can get through the insurance. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think it's to your question, and that's certainly one of the reasons why we would do such a study, is to understand, you know, if your patient is eligible for all these medications, and which ones do you choose? Right. And I would certainly say that our data are convincing enough that if I was picking something, and if we lived in a real world, I would go for the semaglutide, based on this. Now, to your point of the data of over 2 years, I think I agree it's a shorter time period, but you know, the clinical trials are not that much longer either, right? So the mean time of like 54 to 56 or 72 weeks. So we're comparable, but the good thing about using EHR data for such questions is that we could probably look at this again in a year or two and still not have to have a lot of resources doing this. But you know, it's a lot of time, but it's not a matter of years. It's a matter of a few months that we can come up with the answers on that. And it'll certainly be useful to study as an adjunct the impact on you know, progression of kidney disease, really. At least we have the GFR, you know, we have the data on creatinine, we have the data on EGFR. Typically AMR are not reliable on urine albumin ratios and stuff, but again, those data do exist because clinicians check those in CKD patients all the time. So I think those are some very interesting thoughts and futuristic goals that we can look at with this sort of a study.
Well, what I love about this study is that nobody is going to do a randomized controlled trial of two classes of drugs for the same disease. And this is the best way to get at the data and make us think. Now, what I've challenged y'all on is, It's not as simple as this. It's more complicated. But if what we're looking at is trying to decrease stroke and trying to take care of patients early in their course, we did the new diabetes guidelines from the American College of Physicians. We did a podcast on that. And they say after metformin, you should either use a GLP-1 or an SGLT2 before you use anything else. And you've made the argument here for us to consider why at some times you might want to use a particular GLP-1. And then I raised the question of what about the GLP-1 GIP, tirzepatide, that we'll have to catch up with the data on. But this is really valuable for our listeners as they try to make decisions over what drug to use next. So I can't thank you all enough for joining the podcast. It's really, really helpful.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for having us. We really loved it.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This target trial emulation study gives some valuable information and raises as many questions as it answers, and therefore it's hypothesis generating. There's a modest result in this 45 to 64 year age group of semaglutide, but not dulaglutide, decreasing strokes and cardiac events. There was no mortality difference. There was not as much significance in differences above the age of 65. The study has an average duration of 2.2 years, which is similar to randomized controlled trials, but that begs the question of what are going to be the long-term benefits and risks of these two classes. So what we don't know is the time from the onset of type 2 diabetes until the drugs are started, and that's hypothesized as a possibility in this study, but would be very interesting to look at to see if that is a good predictor of the benefits. We'd like to have longer-term data. And finally, it's going to be very interesting to see, is this an impact of weight loss? There's a slight difference in weight loss in this study, and I raised the question of tirzepatide in the future. I think that we need to figure out a little bit more about mechanisms. I'm very glad that they did this study, and it certainly suggests that people who have other risks that being on GLP-1 like semaglutide might be beneficial in patients with type 2 diabetes. Thank you very much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall